This time of year, many of us share a hobby, complaining about the weather and, in turn, road conditions. This winter's given us a lot of fodder, to say the least. Part of the problem is the wave of snowstorms across much of the country has wiped out supplies of rock salt. As Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports, even some places sitting on vast quantities of salt underground are having a hard time getting it onto their streets.
When New York State, a major salt producer, declares a salt shortage, Milwaukee fights road ice with cheese brine, and New Jersey breaks out the pickle juice, you know you've got a widespread salt problem. After a big storm in Wichita, Kansas 2 weeks ago, even busy streets were still snow-packed and icy slick days later.
It kind of sounded like I was in a sardine can for a moment.
Lindsay Durham, a Wichita middle school teacher, is standing in the snow next to her dented car, describing one of many fender benders here.
I think that they were trying to stop, but the streets are so covered in a layer of ice and snow and pack, though it hadn't snowed in 2 days.
If you think Durham's frustrated, talk to Joe Pager, the deputy public works director here.
We didn't have full salt on hand. We relied heavily on 100% sand treatment.
Wichita's got no end of sand here at the Public Works Yard, but sand won't melt snow. For that, you need salt. I mean, there's stronger stuff, magnesium chloride, beet juice, but salt is usually much cheaper. And Wichita's just down the road from a town that calls itself the Salt City.
The salt has been in Hutchinson for 242 million years, and now our challenge was, last week, getting it 60 miles from Hutchinson to Wichita.
Well, first, you have to get the salt out of the ground.
We've just gone and dropped 650 feet vertical. We're at the base of the salt seam.
John Kincaid supervises the Hutchinson salt mine. Miners down here with headlamps cutting beams through the white dust go after walls of rock salt with explosives, drills, and enormous grinders. These men and machines can claw out about 3,000 tons a day. But this winter, even that's not enough.
We have been working 24-7 for several months now.
Harold Mayo, the manager at Hutchinson Salt, says this winter's relentless snowstorms have depleted stockpiles and pushed the salt industry to its limit.
We're getting calls from people who just found us on the internet, just hoping that we have salt. Right now we tell them no. You know, regardless of price, we just don't have it.
Every chunk of salt coming off the conveyor belt here is committed and shipped not long after it sees the surface.
We can't meet demand. The winter has hit everybody hard.
Trucks idle for hours, sometimes even overnight, outside the mine, waiting to load the stuff. Logistical bottlenecks drive up shipping prices. The bitter cold has even frozen major rivers and lakes, blocking barge traffic. Put it all together, and the price of salt delivered to Chicago has jumped as much as fivefold, according to Tom Breyer, who runs Ice Melt Chicago.
We've heard from others that it's actually run up as high as $250 or heavier for a ton of rock salt, which is pretty outrageous when you compare that to the $50 price earlier in the year.
Supplies tight, and demand surges every time there's another big storm.
Our salt supply is extremely low, dangerously low, actually.
Chris Koch, the public works director in Paterson, New Jersey, says he's willing to pay a serious premium for salt. But the shortage isn't spread evenly. Kansas City, Missouri is selling. Mayor Sly James says the proceeds will help cover his city's snow removal bill.
People are calling us to buy our salt, other cities and the state. So we're able to offset any budgetary issues by selling some of the excess that we have.
With all the grief running out of salt causes, you might think cities would just buy more in the summer when it's cheap. But it has to be kept inside to avoid runoff. Most local governments don't have room to house enough salt for a crazy winter like this one. Back in Wichita, the situation is easing. The city is getting the salt it ordered months ago. And warmer weather there may soon usher in the new season of potholes. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
People who grow marijuana illegally in the backwoods of California are poisoning wild animals, including rare ones. They use rat bait and other toxic chemicals to protect their plants. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren visited the Hupa Reservation in Northern California, where tribal members and biologists are worried about the problem.
We scramble through snow-covered brush on a remote hillside.
Here's a marijuana plant that kept growing after it was cut.
The tribe's biologist, Mark Higley, holds up a rotten pot plant. It's left over from a bust last summer. A law enforcement team found 8,000 marijuana plants here, 3 to 6 feet tall. They also found lots of rat poisons and empty containers left over after growers used the toxic chemicals. Here's what happens. The growers irrigate their plants. Rats chew on the plants to get moisture, and that kills the plants. So the growers try to kill the rats.
The problem is we have wild rodents out here that are going to eat the rat poisons, and then they become little time bombs. They don't die for 7 to 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, and they stagger around, and then they become easy prey for northern spotted owl, fisher, foxes, bobcats.
And then when predators eat the poisoned rodents, they get poisoned and sometimes die. Higley says this has become a common scene in forests throughout Northern California. That same week, in a bust in a national forest nearby, sheriff's deputies found a dead fisher. It's a rare relative of the weasel, about the size of a cat. Higley was there. He says the marijuana growers had laced hot dogs with a toxic insecticide and hung them up on large fish hooks.
And then that fisher had hot dog in its esophagus and in its stomach, and died of acute poisoning.
Higley and other biologists study fishers closely because the federal government is considering putting them on the endangered species list. They know what kills them because they tracked them with radio collars. When an animal stops moving, researchers race into the forest to find the body before predators do. In fact, a dead fisher first clued in scientists to the widespread use of these poisons by illegal pot growers. Then researchers went back and looked at tissue samples from fishers that had died in previous years. Nearly all the animals had been exposed to rat poisons. Higley says these poisons caused nearly a third of the deaths of male fishers on the Hooper Reservation over recent years.
It was just devastating. I mean, to know that such a high percentage of the fisher population across the entire range in California was exposed to these rat poisons, and knowing that it's not just fishers, but all the other carnivores have got to be exposed to it, it just seems absolutely criminal.
Particularly on the reservation, the Hoopa tribe banned all toxic chemicals decades ago to protect its natural resources. Aaron Pohl is a wildlife technician and a member of the tribe.
I'm enraged. Why won't they go somewhere else and grow?
Pohl has come across illegal marijuana farms when tracking fishers and rare northern spotted owls. And he's been part of teams cleaning up sites after busts. A big pile of trash is still left over from a cleanup here a couple months ago. It includes empty fertilizer bags and lots of irrigation hose that growers used to bring water from a stream.
It's pretty selfish. You know, it's like they come in and they're reaping the benefit of, you know, some quick cash. All the environmental damage is happening here, and we have to deal with it.
The fishers are a special concern because the tribe uses their skins for arrow quivers in a traditional healing dance. The tribe also worries about poisons getting into fish and game and the rivers where children play. Wildlife ecologist Murad Gabriel is tracking the problem all over the northern half of California. In his lab in a logging town near the coast, he opens a locked freezer and pulls out a corpse of a furry animal.
So you can see here, it's still a little bit frosty, but this is a beautiful, beautiful male fisher.
It was found dead near Yosemite National Park, hundreds of miles away. Gabriel plans to take it to the University of California, Davis, for an examination to determine the cause of death. But these days, whenever a fisher turns up, he suspects rat poisons. He goes in with law enforcement during busts of illegal pot farms, sometimes getting lowered from a helicopter. Afterwards, he hikes back into the spots. He hauls out whatever rat poisons he finds, and he sets up motion-sensing cameras.
Just to see what kind of wildlife actually visits these sites.
He shows me pictures of fishers, mountain lions, gray fox, deer, and a bear.
This bear is actually walking in and investigating bottles of insecticides and fertilizer.
Gabriel recently got the results from the exam of that frozen fisher from Yosemite. It did die from rat poisons. And then earlier this month, Gabriel suffered a very personal blow. His pet dog was poisoned with the same kind of rat bait and died. He thinks it was malicious. The local sheriff is investigating. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
The latest news about natural gas arrives at an awkward moment. American gas drilling is booming, the market is expanding, and natural gas is promoted as a clean fuel, far better to run buses or heat homes than oil. A report in Science magazine concludes those benefits are real, but at the same time, decades of studies have found that natural gas leaks into the air are a potent contributor to climate change, and the new study finds those leaks are greater than the Environmental Protection Agency estimates. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Every year, the EPA does a survey of natural gas production facilities and estimates how much potent methane gas is leaking into the air. But scientists who study methane gas in the atmosphere note that the government estimate is a lowball.
These estimates conflict with what's seen in the atmosphere, and it's been uncertain for some time now where exactly this gap is coming from, and it's still uncertain.
Adam Brandt at Stanford University is among a team of scientists that drew together the latest information to look at this question. They find that there's 50% more methane gas going into the air than the EPA asserts. Some may be from agriculture. Cows and rice paddies produce this gas as well. But Brandt says the natural gas production system of wells and pipes and compressors is also playing a role. And that matters when you ask the question, is it better to produce and burn natural gas or coal to generate electricity?
Although we find that EPA is likely underestimating emissions from the natural gas system, we think that it's still beneficial to switch from coal to gas.
At least when it comes to burning fossil fuels for electricity. That's because burning natural gas produces half as much carbon dioxide as burning coal does. But the study says it actually doesn't make sense from the standpoint of climate change to switch from gasoline or diesel to natural gas as a transportation fuel.
There's lots of other reasons we might want to switch to gas, but from a climate perspective, it doesn't look beneficial.
That assessment could change if the gas industry can track down and fix its leaks. Brandt says that might not be so hard to do based on surveys of natural gas equipment.
A fraction of 1% of the sources are responsible for sometimes over half of the emissions. And these are called super emitters. These are basically devices that are broken, corrosion holes in a pipe or a valve that's broken, and just leaking gas.
The challenge is to sniff out those leaky spots.
We are currently working on several studies that will try and help quantify how frequent are those large emitters and what are their characteristics.
Stephen Hamburg is chief scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund.
If you can take a limited number of actions and reduce a large percentage of the emissions, that's a real win-win for everybody.
EDF is involved in more than a dozen studies of the natural gas system to that end. Last year, they published the first, a look at leaks from wells where operators are using fracking techniques to get at the gas. Hamburg says the studies in progress now are looking more broadly for leaks.
Some of the studies are looking at pieces of the supply chain, so looking at gathering lines and processing, doing additional work on well pads and production, then looking at transmission lines and storage, local distribution systems.
As well as gas leaks related to fueling natural gas-powered vehicles. Hamburg says those studies should be wrapped up this year, and he notes that methane is such a potent greenhouse gas, there's a lot of benefit to be had if you can identify and fix the leaks. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The water has been contaminated for residents in 9 counties. At a congressional hearing in West Virginia, their representatives demanded the answer to that simple question we asked earlier. Is the water safe? Here's Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito questioning the state's Commissioner of Public Health, Letitia Tierney.
Dr. Tierney, is the water safe to drink?
That's, in a way, a difficult thing to say because everybody has a different definition of safe. Am I confident in the science? I believe the water, based on the standards we have, is usable for every purpose, and that includes drinking, bathing, and cooking.
Dr. Rahul Gupta is a public health official at the local level. He's the executive director of the Kanawha Charleston and Putnam County Health Departments. He says the confusing and conflicting guidance from state and federal officials has made life very difficult.
It may be a four-letter term, but it is part of the federal law, the Safe Drinking Water Act. It is not Appropriate Drinking Water Act. It is not Okay Drinking Water Act. Is it safe or is it not safe? And we just, at a local level, don't have the tools to make that determination. We really depend on our state and federal partners, and we continue to seek answers for that one question.
Many residents are disturbed by the lingering telltale sign of chemicals in their water, an oddly sweet smell.
If you go to the store and you get a package of the black licorice,
I think the packages have 20 licorice sticks in it.
Mm-hmm.
You open that up and you take a big sniff. That's exactly what the water smells like in some of these houses.
That's Andrew Welton. He's a professor at the University of South Alabama, and he's part of an independent team that this past week started testing the water at people's homes. He says there are a lot of unknowns about the water, including the fact that there's very little information on how MCHM affects human health.
There's only a few studies that have been conducted on rats and animals, and none of the studies have any human data associated with them or even juvenile animals. There simply isn't much data available to really shore up what levels are completely safe for individuals.
Authorities in West Virginia have been testing the water from the beginning of the crisis. Could you explain, though, why it's important to test the water in people's homes, in individual homes, in this way?
The authorities in West Virginia have been testing water at fire hydrants, schools, and hospitals since the beginning of the crisis. It's important to test inside people's homes because the materials that are used to transport water and to store water outside the homes are very different than those materials that are used to transport water and store water inside the home. Simply put, there's little to no information about what happens to, for example, this contaminated water once it went into people's houses.
Dr. Welton, where does the testing go from here, and when will we have more results?
In the next 3 weeks, we will have been on the ground, and we will have collected all of the data from the 10 homes. So we'll, at that point, we'll have shipped water samples throughout the country. And so we're looking at least a month, if not a month and a half to 2 months, before we'll really have some definitive results.
That was Andrew Welton. Along with his colleague Jeffrey Rosen from Corona Environmental Consulting, he's leading a group thoroughly testing the tap water at people's homes. As he says, it will be at least a month before they get results. Meanwhile, the crisis has already done real psychological damage. Dr. Rahul Gupta.
What we are seeing is obviously a lot of anxiety, panic in some people, anger and frustration. Just a week ago, we've had up to 14 schools in a day report complaints of odors. The day prior to that, we had 2 schools we had to close. The following day after that, we had 3 schools, but there were about 14 schools on the verge of closure. This is all having some cumulative impact on psychological aspects of our children as well as adults. And I think it's important to not neglect to monitor these.
Dr. Gupta, from where you're sitting right now, how long do you think this crisis is going to last?
Well, it needed to be over several weeks ago. It is still continuing. We are hoping that a number of activities can be put in place by our leaders that will help and allow people to heal and to ensure to the public that their water in their taps is safe. It is very critical, I cannot emphasize enough, that people need to know that their water coming out of their taps is safe.
That was Dr. Rahul Gupta. He says people in West Virginia have been left to make their own decisions about whether to use the water. But when authorities won't directly answer if the water is safe, that's no easy choice. This is NPR News. There are some basic things we take for granted, at least in the developed world. That the air we breathe or the water that flows into our homes won't make us sick. So imagine you turn on your local TV news to this.
State of emergency in several counties tonight after a chemical spills into the water supply. Good evening.
In Charleston, West Virginia, this was the news on Thursday, January 9th. A 1-inch hole had opened up in the side of a chemical storage tank, and a substance known as crude MCHM was gushing out into the Elk River and the water supply of some 300,000 people.
Do not drink, use, bathe with, cook with, or do laundry with water from West Virginia American Water. The only thing that you can use it for at this time is to flush your toilet or for fire protection.
That was more than a month ago. State and federal authorities have said that the water is now usable for all purposes. But in some areas, the tap water still has a chemical odor, leaving a lot of ordinary West Virginians and some health authorities wondering, is the water really safe? That's our cover story today. Despite assurances from government officials, many people in West Virginia are still going to great lengths to avoid the tap water. NPR's Brian Naylor went to Charleston, and as he reports, life there is anything but normal.
Nate May's Prius is loaded down with water. The back is filled with boxes, each holding 3 1-gallon jugs that he's just bought at Walmart. He and other volunteers are driving around Charleston, dropping off jugs to people who have contacted his group, the West Virginia Clean Water Hub. It's a citizen effort operating on donations.
There are a lot of people this is put in a difficult bind. Some of them can't get out. Some of them are elderly. Some of them, it's just too much of a financial burden.
One of his first stops this morning, the second floor apartment of Nakisha Bennett.
Nakisha, I'm here to deliver some water. I'm with the Clean Water Hub. Your dad told me about you.
I'm sorry, I was feeding my baby.
No problem.
Nakisha's baby is 3-week-old Eli.
I actually was like in the middle of like eating dinner and drinking water. Yeah, and I was pregnant, so I started freaking out.
What did the doctors tell you?
They just told me to drink the bottled water and stuff.
And so now with his formula, you mix it with bottled water?
Yeah, and that's kind of hard to do, because we went through cases and cases and cases of water.
Nakisha says she has no idea how long she'll have to go on fixing Eli's formula and bathing him with bottled water, and she's pretty fed up.
I just feel like there are, like, a lot of people who, are, like, aren't doing their jobs or something. I mean, it's hard. I cannot live like this with the bottled water. It drives me crazy that I can't just use regular water out of my sink.
Charleston is the state's population center, the center of its government. And there are lawyers and lobbyists and other people here who know how to make themselves heard. Maya Nye, who's president of People Concerned About Chemical Safety, says maybe this leak will have an impact in a way that previous accidents in more isolated places in West Virginia have not.
I do believe it's a tipping point. 300,000 people, you hit them on sort of a basic human survival level, and I mean, this has been ongoing for a month now, you know, and I'm still not drinking the water, using it, and a lot of people I know still aren't.
West Virginia's members of Congress have called for laws to ensure testing of storage tanks like the one owned by Freedom Industries that leaked, and for more oversight of West Virginia's many other chemical facilities. But University of Charleston professor Brad Deal isn't optimistic that big changes are coming in the state's light-handed regulation of the coal and chemical industry.
What I predict will happen is that people are going to make a lot of noise. There will be some minor regulations passed. To the extent anything major is proposed, people will say, well, let's not be too hasty. Let's not make any rash changes. Industry will open its wallets and its lobbying organizations to the politicians, and very little will happen.
Meanwhile, in St. Albans, just outside Charleston's water system,
we came here and did a little pizza picnic. And then now we're finishing with that.
Sounds like a great adventure.
It has been. Can you guys say hello? These are my
friends.
Come on, let's let them in the house.
Hi.
Is that the gentleman? Cool.
Joanne Kirby and her 3 lively kids are having a pizza picnic. Kirby lives in Charleston, but along with 3 other families, has rented a small apartment in St. Albans so they can bathe the kids and wash their clothes in clean water. The families use a Google Calendar to keep track of whose turn it is to use the place. Kirby, a lawyer, says their family doesn't use the water in their home at all.
One day, my daughter was brushing her teeth, and she turned on the faucet by mistake and wet her toothbrush and then just dropped it and burst into tears. And, you know, that's not a great feeling as a parent. You know, you're doing the best to keep a routine and keep calm, yet the kids pick up on the tension, and they're aware.
Aurelia Kirby is 6.
And Mommy said, even if other kids are using the water, we do not use the water.
Richard Katz is another lawyer whose family shares the unfurnished apartment.
It works out real well. It's worked out great so far. Unfortunately, I'm afraid we might have to have the place for another month at least.
Katz and the other families know they're fortunate to have the means to escape Charleston's water. Katz says unless it's resolved soon, the water crisis may make some people escape the area for good.
I can tell you from talking with other professionals here, other highly skilled workers, that we're watching. And if there is no meaningful change, there will be a brain drain here.
As these families leave their shared apartment, the last thing they do is turn on the faucet and fill some jugs to take home.
That's NPR's Brian Naylor.
Yellowstone National Park is famous for its geysers, like Old Faithful. There are also cauldrons of boiling mud that smell like sulfur and steaming hot springs with sapphire blue pools. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports that scientists who study all of this gurgling recently discovered something unexpected bubbling up out of the ground.
Underneath Yellowstone National Park is a huge sleeping volcano. Bill Evans works for the U.S. Geological Survey, and he says Wyoming is a strange place to find a volcano. Usually, volcanoes form at the edges of the tectonic plates that make up the Earth's crust, but the Yellowstone volcano is in the middle of a plate.
Something that has not been busted up over geologic time. It's a part of the crust that formed a very long time ago, billions of years ago. And it's basically been stable since that time.
But the plate is now moving over a hot spot, and a plume of molten rock from deep within the earth is pushing up into these old rocks.
They've had this boring, peaceful existence, and now suddenly they're put on the front burner. They're really getting cooked.
This cooking is doing something surprising. Evans and his colleagues look for clues about what's happening underground by collecting the gases that rise up. Jake Lowenstern of the U.S. Geological Survey says they stick probes in the ground or hold funnels over bubbling pools.
Just a simple plastic funnel that allows the gas to get into our tube without any air getting in. So that's important. We don't want to analyze air. Everybody knows the composition of air. They don't know the composition of the gases that are bubbling through the pools.
They analyzed these gases back in the lab.
And we had sort of an aha moment where we realized, wow, there's a lot of crustal helium coming out of Yellowstone, far more than we would have predicted.
That's a type of helium produced by the radioactive decay of elements in the Earth's crust. And as the researchers report in the journal Nature, the amount being released by the rocks below Yellowstone is, quote, prodigious. Each week, about enough to fill a Goodyear blimp. Evans says this must be coming from a vast store of helium that accumulated until the rocks started to feel the heat.
The gases that have been trapped in those rocks, happily sitting there for hundreds of millions of years, is now driven out. You know, it's kind of an interesting thought to us is how these rocks behave, because it's very rare on the face of the Earth to have volcanism come into rocks that have been that stable for that long.
The only real practical applications of this discovery are for geologists, who use helium to do things like figure out the age of groundwater supplies. So don't expect to someday be blowing up party balloons with helium from Yellowstone. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.